Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Rico Muhammad coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, I'm in Forest Park, Georgia tonight. I'm over at my shipper trying to get ready to get loaded. So a little bit later on in the show, you may hear a little bit of noise or something in the background, me backing into the door. Just know that this is the Rakes and Lanes podcast coming to you live, and that I am Rico Muhammad. I'm not someone with college degrees or nothing like that as far as that can come and talk to you on this podcast about from a real high analytical spectrum as far as the Rakes and Lanes is concerned. I'm just average Joe out here with his own authority working my company, and can give you some advice and things that have helped me on my way and give you some real life experience and in the trenches, real deal rates of that nature. Tonight we will have our special guest Henry Heaton on. I just got off the phone with him. He is doing a little housekeeping right now. He wants me to call him back in about 2 or 3 minutes, and I will get him back on the line. But in the meantime, in between time, the show as we normally do, and we are going to jump right over into the fruit and vegetable truck rate report from the USDA right now and see what they have to say for this week's on their report. And this week we don't have any areas with a shortage reporting as far as the USDA is concerned. We have a couple of areas that show slight shortages. And those areas are the San Luis Valley, Colorado, Upper Valley, Twin Falls, Burley District, Idaho, Merrill County, Oregon, Aroostook County, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, and North Dakota are reporting slight shortages. Eastern North Carolina and Nebraska checking in with slight shortages. New York is reporting slight shortages, and Yakima Valley in Washington State is reporting a slight shortage as far as their USDA fruit and vegetable truck report. If you want to see this report for yourself, there's much more greater detail on this report. So if you happen to be a reefer hauler, and like I've told people before, if you don't know, you can haul just about some produce and vegetables on any type of equipment. You can do it on flatbed, you can do it on reefer, you can do it on step decks, dry vans, vented vans. So it may behoove you to check out this report and, you know, kind of add it to your repertoire. It comes out every Wednesday, sometimes about after lunchtime. You can just Google USDA truck rate report or fruit and vegetable report. Just Google that, and that'll pretty much give you the link. It's a little complicated trying to get to it directly from the USDA website. And this week, let's check in real quickly with the DAT trend lines and see what's coming off of the reports that DAT sends out for January the 11th through the 17th. The truckload capacity added 24% last week, the first indicator of a more typical slow winter freight season. Freight rates slipped lower for vans, flatbeds, and reefers, as did fuel surcharges. So that's kind of a brief overview of the whole thing. Let's jump over and get into a little bit more specific. And let's look at the U.S. national van demand and capacity for January the 11th through the 17th. And van freight availability was stable last week, and capacity expanded 24% compared to the previous week. The load-to-truck ratio declined 20% from 3.9 to 3.1 loads per truck, which is still relatively strong for the season. December van ratio up 5.9%. And the national ratio averaged 3.7% for vans in December, and a 5.9% increase compared to November, 0.7% above the level of December of 2013. Low post increased on both a month-over-month and a year-over-year basis. And let's get over into the U.S. van rates. January 11th through the 17th, the national average rate for vans declined another 3 cents per mile last week, dropping below $2 for the first time since May. The line haul portion of the rate slipped 2 cents, and the average fuel surcharge lost 1 cent. And with that said, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, I'm here at my shipper getting ready to get loaded. They just getting ready to put me in the door. So bear with me just a second. This is just another indication that I wanted to let everyone know, once again, that we're not someone just sitting off in the office somewhere with a little cushy job and just sitting at a computer screen and reading this stuff off on a computer to you, that we are actually out here in the field doing this. We are not just, from a standpoint of just talking about this stuff. We are actually out here in the with our faces to the grindstone doing it with you. So sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. I just try to keep everybody abreast as to what is really going on. And I don't want people to feel like they're intimidated when they call in on the Rachel Lane podcast, because, like I said, I'm just a regular guy just like you out here doing this thing and trying to do the best I can as well. And we get better by sharing information and maybe sharing a couple of different pointers and tips that can help everyone out with this quest to get better at getting better freight and getting better rates while we're out here. So give me just a second, and I'm going to back into this hole, and we'll get right back to the podcast. And we just about got it in the hole. All right. Thank you, everyone, for bearing with me through that brief interruption. And I'm going to pick right back up. We were talking about the U.S. van rates. And for December, the rates rise 7.2%. The monthly average van rate achieved an off-season peak in December at $2.08 per mile, including the fuel surcharge, compared to the same month in 2013. Van rates were up 7.2%. And a quick check around the country for the average rates. Philadelphia checks in with an average van rate of $1.83 per mile. Atlanta checks in with an average van rate of $2.04 per mile. Chicago checks in with $2.20 on average for vans. Dallas shows a $1.81 on average. And Los Angeles is showing an average rate of $2.12 for the dry van market. Moving on over to U.S. flatbed demand for the week of January the 11th through the 17th, flatbed load availability rose 6.1%, and truckload capacity posted another strong gain of 28%. The load-to-truck ratio lost 17% for the week, from 16.5 down to 13.7 loads per truckbed ratio. Load volume dipped 1.2% for flatbeds in December compared to November, and the capacity increased 3.1%, yielding a 4.2% decline in the load-to-truck ratio month over month. The ratio rose 12.6% compared to December 2013, however, due primarily to increased demand. And we're going to check over and see what we're looking like on U.S. flatbed rates for the 11th through the 17th. And it says here that flatbed rates dipped 4 cents last week to $2.25 per mile, including a 1 cent decline in the average fuel surcharge. Rates were down. The national average rate for flatbeds fell 2 cents in December to $2.29 compared to December of 2013. However, flatbed rates rose 12 cents, a 5.5% per mile increase on the percentage wise. Check in on the national flatbed rates around the country. Harrisburg checks in at $3.98 per mile on average. Atlanta, Georgia checks in with a $2.57 per mile average. Rock Island over in the Midwest shows $2.67 per mile on average. Houston, Texas checks in at $2.63 per mile on average. And Phoenix, Arizona shows a $1.85 per mile average for flatbeds. And last but certainly not least, we're going to jump over into the U.S. reefer demand for the week of the 11th through the 17th. And demand for reefers declined 8.9% last week, and capacity added 20%, signaling a seasonal slowdown in much of the country. The load-to-truck ratio declined 24% from 13.4 to 10.1 reefer loads per truck. December, the reefer load availability rose 4.1% and capacity added 8.3% in December compared to November, this resulting in a load-to-truck ratio that dipped 4.2% to 10.6 compared to December of 2013. The ratio declined 5.3%. And let's look at U.S. reefer rates, and then we're going to go over and try to get Mr. Seaton back on the line with us. And the average rate, January the 11th through the 17th, the national average for reefers declined another 6 cents last week to $2.29 per mile. The line haul portion of the rate fell 5 cents, and the average fuel surcharge dropped 1 cent. Rates up 14% versus 2013. So there's a little silver lining to the cloud. Reefer rates slipped 1 cent in December to a national average of $2.36 per mile compared to December of 2013. Rates rose 29 cents year-over-year, percent increase. And we're showing rates here on average coming out of Elizabeth, New Jersey at $2.13 per mile for national reefer rates, average rates. Lakeland, Florida shows an average reefer rate of $1.71 per mile. Green Bay, Wisconsin checks in at $3.09, leading the pack. And McAllen, Texas checks in at $2.38 per mile on average, which is not bad. And Fresno checks in at $2.17 per mile on average. And with that said, let's see if we can get our esteemed guest back on the line with us, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll see if we can get them plugged in here in just a second.
Okay.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have Mr. Hank Seaton on tonight with us. Hank, just we got you plugged in. Hank, how are you doing tonight?
Doing well.
Good. Glad to have you on. And just want to remind everyone that's on the line, if you got a question, a transportation law question or anything like that, you go ahead and press the number one. That will put you in the queue so that you can get in line to ask your question directly to Mr. Seaton. Well, Hank, what's new? What you got going on before we jump into any questions or anything else? What's been going on in your world?
Well, I've been traveling around making some presentations to different groups, primarily on shipper broker contracts and some nasty trends we're seeing in terms of cargo liability and indemnity issues. And other than that, it seems like I've been busy and blessed with a bunch of kind of strange transportation questions. hauling different commodities, different models of operation. It's been a busy and blessed time for me.
And given the fact that I think that we've went through a little bit of a growth spurt, and we've got a couple of few, we have a few new listeners that may be tuning in tonight, and I think it might be a good idea for us tonight to maybe take a little bit of a step back and go over, review some other things that we may have talked about previously. I got a question. Someone sent me a question the other day, and they were talking about the secret weapon in the drawer, which they were referring to, the motor carrier tariffs. Now, there was an article that they sent me, and I'll just touch on it briefly, and maybe you can comment on it after I touch on some of these points that they had in this article here. And it has a question here: motor carrier tariffs, weren't they abolished? You don't need them, so why bother? Why would any judge pay attention to one of those? And the person in the article goes on to explain, well, you can't think about it so fast. Congress abolished the ICC. It only said the tariffs were not required to be filed, that it did not eliminate, but they were not eliminated. And that, in fact, that Congress allowed carriers to rely on their tariffs to limit their liability for freight damages, establish rates and rules, and avoid showing shippers and avoiding the showing shippers the tariffs unless asked. Any carrier that operates without a tariff is missing a great opportunity to protect itself in a dispute with a shipper. And I think the key word in that is shipper. And maybe one of the points that we can, I know we talked about it before, but in a lot of these broker contracts and stuff like that, they make you waive a lot of your rights under, when you go in and you initially sign these broker contracts and these broker agreements, they make you waive a lot of your rights and stuff like that. And I just want to maybe touch back on some of the rights and everything that, that you do enjoy if you don't sign your rights away.
Sure. Before I answer any questions, let me ask you one. Who wrote the article? It sounds like something I might write.
Let's see. I don't see a byline.
While you're looking, it says
related attorney. Our article was originally published in 2004. This article contained consult with an attorney, but it says related attorneys was John W. Bryant.
Yes, I remember John Bryant. Yeah. Let me, for the listeners, let me explain that the article is still correct. Back over 30 years ago now, when interstate transportation was regulated, there was no such thing really as a contract carrier, and every carrier had operating rights, published service terms and conditions, which were actually on file in Washington, D.C., and which applied to their holding out. And because of something called the file rate doctrine, you had to charge everybody the same rate for the same service and hold them and have the same credit terms, and it had to be exactly what was on file in Washington. The result of that was that motor carriers really had the best of the deal because just like somebody who makes hamburgers, he could say, I'm going to make them my way, and if you want to eat the hamburger, you'll eat it how I make it. But as a result of deregulation and the great supply of new motor carriers who came in the industry, shippers and brokers quickly took advantage of a provision in the statute which allowed a written bilateral contract between a shipper and broker on the one hand and a carrier on another to trump a carrier's service terms and conditions. So that the way the law now reads, a shipment under a bill of lading moves subject to carrier service terms and conditions, or tariffs, which must be produced upon request, or a written bilateral contract. And the way it's set up is if you sign a contract, that contract is probably in writing going to say that if you have a service terms and conditions, they are waived. It's what's called an integration clause in all these contracts. It says this is all we're agreeing to, and nothing else is out there. That doesn't mean that it's not good business for every carrier to have at least a simple rules tariff and to try to incorporate it into every line of haul. You'll typically see a broker contract that doesn't say a thing about things like detention and waiting time and just the basic kind of accessorial charges that you need. So unless you have an accessorial chart or can incorporate one by reference, you then play this happy hijack situation when you don't get unloaded for 3 days and the broker says, I'm sorry, Charlie, what do you expect me to do about paying you? So there are a lot of things in a rules tariff that are good practice. And if you want to mimic the big boys, particularly the regular route carriers and most of the truckload carriers, they have rules tariffs that they try to negotiate into contracts. Now, the idea of saying, well, don't ask, don't tell, I've got these rules, tariffs, and I'll play surprise with a shipper when I get in trouble, is, I don't think, a particularly ethical way to do business, and it can get you in trouble. So, A, you need a rules tariff, but if you don't have a written contract and you do have a rules tariff, one thing you better get very, very clear is if you want to limit your cargo liability, under the liability statutes, you have to tell the shipper in advance what your limit of liability is, and you have to offer him an opportunity to elect among two or more rates. So you can't just stick in your bottom drawer that our limit of liability is $100,000 a truckload and then hope to overcome an improvident stolen load worth $700,000. So what I'm telling you is, for that reason, if you don't get in a written contract that your maximum liability is $100,000, or you don't give the shipper notice that that your rules tariff is applicable and it has a limit of liability, and give him the opportunity to choose, under the law, you can have to eat a cargo loss that far exceeds your cargo limits. So that's a long way to kind of introduce you into it. Rico has mentioned before, I wrote a book called Protecting Motor Carrier Interest in Contracts, and a lot of that goes into explaining the difference between a bill of lading, which is a contract incorporating either a written contract or a tariff. That's one article of contracting. Another is this rules tariff that Rico is talking about that's very important. And the third, of course, is the written bilateral contract. Now, one of the things that I mentioned to Rico that I am talking about is whether or not we have reached the tipping point in which the contracts have gotten so outrageous that an average carrier can't sign one, and whether or not the shortage of trucks is such that now we have negotiating muscle to just say no. And I think we're about there, where the shipping public is going to have to exercise some restraint, or the carrier public, on what they'll sign.
That's it. You lead me into a lot of great points. When I originally started out, when I was going to make the decision that I was going to get my own authority, I went to a NASTIC class, which is where I heard about Mr. Seaton before NASTIC, but at NASTIC, during the new entrant survival training class that they give, which is part of their requirements for joining NASTIC, they gave everyone a copy of Mr. Seaton's book, Protecting Motor Carriers' Interests in Contracts. And for the average Joe that's out here moving freight, I highly recommend, if you don't have anything else, you have to have this. If you see my copy, it's so tattered and dog-eared and highlighted and bookmarked. I probably need to invest in another copy. But don't have this book. Please go in, to Mr. Seaton's website. It's called transportationlaw.net. I'm going to say it again, transportationlaw.net. It's spelled out just the way it sounds, transportationlaw.net. There is a way that you can order the book right there on Mr. Seaton's website, and also there are a ton of other interesting articles and everything in there. And just to highlight a couple of quick things on the book, part one, Mr. Seaton talks about contracts with shippers and brokers. Part two, owner-operator contracts. Part three, talks about insurance contracts. Part four, it talks about factoring agreements. And he also has in there some different appendices where it shows you standard truckload bill of ladings, the shipper carrier agreements, so on and so forth. Just something that you definitely want to have in your repertoire, something that you can, as a point of reference, if you have something going on. And when I seen this, and I had the ability through NASTIC to make contact, I tried to make contact with Mr. Seaton. That's what kind of really led us on this journey with me trying to get Mr. Seaton to come on a monthly basis to come on the show, because the average guy out here moving freight, these are the things that, and Mr. Seaton touched on it ever so, he put it perfectly. Some of these contracts that are coming out now, you damn near have to have your own legal cabinet to review some of these things. I mean, I have seen some 20-30 page manifestos, I call them, that they want you to sign, you know, and you're trying to, you're just out here wanting to move some freight, trying to put food on the table.
Yeah, Rico, the ordinary small carrier who's looking for backhaul freight will probably get a contract that's 10 or 12 pages long. The jumbo daddy of them all that I just reviewed was a 72-page contract for a broker client by someone in oil field that never mentioned the term motor carrier, never mentioned the term broker, and never mentioned the term cargo loss. It required the broker to indemnify and hold harmless the shipper for anything that happened and treated the broker as if he were just a contractor. Now, if a broker were to sign that, he would end up engaging in what I call promise them anything and cram it down on the carrier. And for a long time, brokers, in order to solicit freight from shippers, have agreed to whatever outrageous requirements the shipper had and then taken the position of, oh, well, I can cover my risk by making the carrier make me whole if he screws up and I get caught. And that system doesn't really work very well because the small carrier particularly doesn't have enough money to make the broker whole. I'll give you a couple of horror stories for that. In one recent case, broker put in a contract that the carrier would be responsible for special and consequential damages for any loss or damage to cargo in transit. Now, ordinarily, you would have limited your liability to, let's say, $100,000 a truckload, and that's your cargo limit. Well, this little carrier had two thefts, and each one was $250,000, and its cargo insurance company paid the $250,000 on both cargo losses, only to find out that the broker then withheld all freight charge payments, claiming that the contractual rights allowed him to be recompensed for his alleged loss of business because the shipper who hired him decided, we've had two cargo losses on the carriers you hired, we're not going to do business with you. The amount of money that he claimed he was out was far more than the little carrier could pay. So here the poor guy had bought insurance, a lot of insurance, that had covered two losses and still was put out of business by a contract term he signed. I'll give you one more tipping point case. There is a company called Southern Refrigerated Transport. They are a subsidiary of a very large carrier, and they are sophisticated people when it comes to reviewing contracts. A contract slipped by them. And the contract provided that they would have to have cargo insurance in the amount of $250,000. The contract did not say that their limit of liability would be $250,000. Rush to the end of the story, they had a very expensive load of pharmaceuticals stolen. And when the lawsuit was over, they owed $7.8 million on a cargo loss.
Wow.
Yeah, now that is what I'm calling the tipping point, because that has percolated up to every motor carrier who said, if so goes SRT, then so can go me. And it's just a take-home for the fact that you have to watch what you sign. One of the other real issues, and I don't know how many people on the line haul food-grade materials or reefer carriers, but very typically you'll find that maybe as many as 30%, I would assume, of the small carriers or listeners do refrigerated work. It's what we call reject it, crush it, and dump it. The shipping community has become so frightened about contamination of product that they either put in the contracts or put in their load confirmation sheets or on their bill of lading that if a shipment is rejected, it can, at the discretion of the shipper, be destroyed. The result is, in one case of sausages, the shipper broke the carrier broke the seal in the consignee's yard after he'd cleared the gate. But before he backed into the dock, the receiver rejected the load of sausage, and the court said that the poor carrier was responsible for the full value of the sausage that the shipper would not even feed to the dogs. There was absolutely nothing wrong with the sausage. It wasn't out of temperature around. There wasn't any evidence that anyone had tampered with the contents of the trailer. But the way the contract was worded, the court ruled that the carrier had assumed that obligation. And the most frightening part about that is, guess what? The carrier's insurance company wouldn't pay the loss. And the reason the carrier's insurance company wouldn't pay the loss is because they did not agree in their insurance contract to allow the carrier to waive reasonable mitigation of the salvage value of the goods. So, particularly in refrigerated commodities, this is becoming a problem, and their new proposed USDA requirements that are coming down that are going to make it more difficult for carriers to handle perishable foodstuffs without incurring cargo claims. And part of what we've been talking about, and I'll pass this along to listeners, is how do you deal in contracts and in service terms and conditions with this very issue of confining the claim to an insurable risk.
Well, Hank, we got a couple people raising their hands wanting to get in and ask some questions. And if
okay.
you want to get in and ask the questions, go ahead and press number one, and we can bring you right up live, and you can ask your question directly to Mr. Hank Seaton right here. And we're going to go to caller calling in from the 941 area code. Don't have my screener tonight. But caller, you're on live. You're hanging with Hank and Rico on the Rakes and Lanes podcast. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, Hank and Mr. Seaton. Great conversation. I was curious, I'm sure a lot of listeners are, like I am, about to get into this. Would it make sense? Is it worth the money? Approximately how much would you charge to have these contracts sent to you and looked over before we commit to them?
Well, like most lawyers, I charge by the hour. You send me a 72-page contract, I'd probably tell you to save your money and don't sign it. But ordinarily, it's probably about $350 to look at an average 10 to 12 page contract and mark it up. You know, the shorter the contract, the quicker I can work, the less the charge. It is a question, you know, if you're going to do just a load by load with somebody, The book will outline the contents of the Dirty Dozen, and you can probably get yourself trained to recognize where the pitfalls are and to address them. The real issue, I think, is lots of times people will sign a contract with Charlie's brokerage thinking, well, this is just for one load. I don't have to fly spec it. And then they wake up a year and a half later and find out that they've got 15 loads that Charlie isn't paying them for because he's offsetting against a bogus claim. So the problem is not just probably the individual loads you sign, but particularly if you're going to do any volume with business with people, if you take that list of the Dirty Dozen, you can highlight them. And, you know, I have some clients that will send me as kind of a tutorial, say, hey, Hank, here are the changes I've made in the contract. Review it and see if I'm on board and if you need to make more. And then, you know, after we do two or three of those, it may be that they just call me because they've got indemnity questions or they've got contorted language that they can't read. I mean, obviously, I'm in business to review contracts, and I'd be happy to review anybody's contract. I tend to find that it is the larger clients who who are looking at big volume, who are able and willing to pay me as an outside lawyer to read every contract.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, and that was, you kind of led me into a little bit of another question that I was going to ask you. He perfectly laid it out there, but if you get the book, like I said, and Hank explained it, if you get the book, it'll kind of, when you start to read the book, Protecting Motor Carriers' Interests and Contracts, there are a couple of things in there, and it's really a really good read, written pretty much in plain English where you can understand it. It doesn't have a bunch of legalese, but he gives specific examples on, Hank calls them the dirty dozens, but specific contract clauses that you need to be on the lookout about. So when you start to see these in some of your contracts, it should throw your antennas up and make you begin to say, "Oh, wait a minute, let me look into this a little bit more deeply." We got another caller with another question. Hank, caller calling in from the 704 area code. You're on live with Rico and Hank. How can we help?
Hey, Rico, it's Jim in Charlotte here. Hey, Hank.
Hey, Jim, how are you doing?
Hi, Jim, how are you?
Good. I'm just, I think Rico knows, but Hank, I'm just starting Authority hopefully this Friday. We used to work for a Roadrunner out of Wisconsin for the last 6 years as, what do you call it, lease, we were leased onto Roadrunner where all this stuff would be there.
Yeah, owner-operator.
Exactly. I'm hearing what you're saying. I've got a quick question not related. Well, first I'll ask the car, is this what you've been talking about? We had hauled recently a lot of loads for like C.H. Robinson or SEVA Logistics, CEVA. Generally, they're not going to, if I drop a contract, none of these brokers are going to sign anything, are they? You know, if I give them, if I say as a new carrier, I want you to sign this, generally we have to sign with their thing, but they don't ever seem,
you have you just getting started, have very little negotiating room with the larger carriers that you've signed with. And, you know, I guess that's the free market system. But what you will see is with certain, let's don't talk about brokers, I don't want to be broker basher, but certain shippers, there are certain shippers who will say to you, look, if you want to haul for us, you better sign this contract. And the distribution man will say, and you can't change a word of it. We've never changed a blank fill-in-the-blank contract for anybody. And then the contract gets referred to me, and I call up the traffic manager and say, these are the changes I want to make. And he says, oh, I remember you, and he makes the changes. The reason being is to get capacity from larger clients, he has made changes. But the little guy doesn't have the clout and hasn't been traditionally needed, so it's just been easier to say, well, if you want our freight, we can't, special orders upset us, and we're not going to make a special order out of a single load. So, yes, it's right that, if you religiously practice the idea of just say no, if the contract's not to your complete liking, you'll lose some freight. And when I mentioned the tipping point, it's certainly something that I am preaching to my broker clients. Listen, you're going to need to come off some of these draconian and rigorous contract provisions, or you're not going to get capacity. You know,
right.
Carriers are
right.
Going to wake up to the fact that, I got cargo insurance. You file a cargo claim with my insurance company. Don't withhold it from my freight charges. I can't very well. I got to live off my cash flow. I got to. I can't wait to have you hold up $50,000 in freight charges while the cargo claim's getting litigated.
Well,
that's a spiral of death for small guys. If you factor it, you probably got recourse factor. The recourse is the factor owes you in the time it takes somebody to litigate the claim.
Right. Nice. Well, do you mind me asking, let's just pick one, like, since C.H. Robinson is the world's biggest broker, say, I mean, have you looked at, like, as a small startup, is their contract generally acceptable to someone like me in terms of what I'm on the hook for, in terms of cargo damage? Or I'm sure you've looked at their general agreement, you know, for a, you know, a sign-up package, I'm guessing, huh?
Well, I don't want to go on to live mic and start criticizing particular brokers. You know,
okay.
I will say this about C.H. Robinson. They do have a unilateral offset provision in their contract. A lot of that comes out of the fact that, you know, they were a produce broker. They have been, in my experience, fairly benign in terms of how they enforce it.
Okay.
You know, while legally, you know, I would not recommend you sign a contract that had a unilateral right of offset. C.H. Robinson has generally not been over anxious to just withhold a claim from somebody without some notice or cause. But it's not my role to vouch for or slam any particular broker. Offline, I will tell you that there is certainly one person in that space that I've had so much trouble with, I would not recommend, but it's not CHR.
Maybe I will call you and pay for an hour if you can give me. I mean, I would pay you for person-to-person information on some of the troublesome ones, so I can just take them off my list. Is that acceptable if I give you a call for your hour?
Well, I don't mind chatting with you, but you know, I guess all I could give you is my opinion. I don't want to slander anybody over the airways.
Right, and then you could be in trouble.
And you know, I'm just saying that as a general trend of negotiating, I think that hopefully it'll come back to the general rules of commerce, the basic rules of the road that is not based upon leverage or market dominance or how bad the carrier needs the load or how bad the shipper needs the load move, but just kind of a standard that's fair. And I mean, I
right.
think ultimately part of my presentation was to suggest that brokers who expect to promise the shipper anything and cram it down on the carriers are doing themselves no favors. They're doing themselves no favors with respect to cargo claims, because ultimately the poor carrier's insurance company isn't going to pony up, and they're going to run the carrier out of business and have to pay that shipper claim if they accept cargo liability. It ultimately doesn't do the broker any good if he guarantees the carrier that he'll pay the carrier regardless of whether he's paid by the shipper. In an effort to cut off the carrier's recourse, only to have his shipper go bankrupt or his shipper withhold a huge cargo claim from him, and it certainly doesn't do the broker any good to accept carrier duties in his contract with his shipper only to be sued when the carrier he hires is involved in an accident. So, you know, I think I could probably, if we had a room full of brokers or carriers, talk our way through this whole question of risk allocation and find out that promising the shipper more than is necessary required under the law is toxic to both brokers and carriers.
I understand. Jim,
I'm at the limit to the one. I'll let you get one more in, but we got a bunch of people that's starting to raise their hand now.
No. It's the more different people, the better. I'll call again. Thank you much, Hank, for the info, and I'll just catch you when you're not here next
Good
time.
Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Me a shout.
Okay.
All right, Jim, we appreciate the call. Want to just try to make sure we get everyone in the time allotted. If you got a question, we probably can still get you in. Just press number one. We're going to go to caller calling in from the area code 706. You're calling in live. You're hanging with Rico and Hank on the Racing Lanes podcast. What's your name and how can we help?
Hi, my name is Chad Richardson. Thanks for taking my call, Rico. I'm going to get my flatbed trailer next month, and I was wondering every load I get, will I have to sign a contract with the brokers, and do I have to come up or provide a contract for them to sign as well?
Well, if you're going to get...
Go ahead. You're the guest, and you're the professional on this thing. I'll let you.
Well,
let me ask
the caller a question. Is he gonna operate under his own authority?
Yes, I'm doing power only now. I just gotta get my trailer, so I would purchase my trailer next month, and then I would join my dad. I'm a member of OIDA, so then I would start getting a break from the low for the stock market.
Okay, well, if you're going to go to the load board as a one-truck operation, you are most likely going to take a load off the load board, call the broker. He'll be reluctant to do business with you because you're a newbie and don't have a track record. But then he'll, if he needs you to move the load bad enough, and in the flatbed industry, there is indeed a shortage, particularly on the time of the year, he'll then send you his written bilateral contract and say, if you're stuck in Omaha and you need to go, you need to sign this contract, ink it in all these places, send it back without changing it together with your certificate of insurance, and we'll give you the load. You'll probably have very little negotiating room, particularly on the load boards. People in the flatbed industry can probably escape that if you're going to stay close to home, or as you mentioned, you're in a power only situation. You may be able to find one or two shippers that you can arrange some round trip or some short haul business with that won't insist on you signing these. They call it adhesion contracts in the law. You know, it's one of these things kind of like the guy at the payday loan company says, you know, don't read it, just sign it, you know. So you will have a variety of these kinds of things to engage in. It probably is worth your while to try to find the best of the best broker who your friends, be they from Elite or your other contacts, they have reasonable contracts and treat to their subcontractor as well, and try to hang with them rather than being searching a load every Monday morning.
And the only thing that I'm gonna add, and the thing that I would add to that is, don't limit yourself to just saying, okay, I need freight and I gotta go deal with these brokers. You have a golden opportunity when the FMCSA has granted you your authority, you have a golden opportunity to go out here and talk directly to shippers. Find out the places right there in your backyard and start going in and introducing yourself to those people and see if you can't deal with them directly. And if they deal with flatbed freight, you know what I'm saying, on the outbound side, it may be a possibility that they may need stuff on the inbound side. So you want to ask the question, where do your inbound freight come from? Where does it come from? And can I help you out with your inbound freight as well? But try your best initially starting out. You know, you may have to read a couple of books on some sales calls or maybe do some webinars on doing some sales if you're not 100% confident or comfortable doing sales. But in business, sales is your lifeblood. And everyone on the phone call tonight, and you know, we've kind of been on this little bit of a mantra, but we're preaching, hey, everybody got to brush up on their sales skills. And we need to be going out here and taking control of our business by going out here and trying to talk to people specifically and eliminating as much broker freight as we can. Not saying that, and this is not to bash brokers, because there are some excellent and great brokers out there, but the less people that you have taking cutting into the cost of the freight, that's more money for your bottom line. And at times, if you develop good relationships with some brokers and 3PLs, sometimes that might be your best way as far as getting direct freight. But never eliminate the possibility of talking to a customer directly or shipper directly.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And in the flat,
Rico, I went to a master class as well. Which book you were saying? Because I had received so many books through that master entry training.
It's a book called Protecting Motor Carrier's Interests in Contract, written by Henry Seaton.
Okay, freight motor carrier contract.
Protecting motor carrier's interests in contract.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks a lot, Rico. I'm going to let you get to some more calls.
Thank you. And we got a caller calling in from area code 817. You're on live with Rico and Hank. Caller, what's your name and how can we help?
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you. I'm actually a broker, but I'm trying to help one of my drivers out. he took one of my loads last week and it was oversized, and he was issued a ticket in the state of Florida because I guess he's run this lane for me for several years, and I guess they have changed the law on what time of the day he can travel. He rolled into a weigh station about 2:30 in the afternoon, and they've cut off the time to 12 o'clock in Florida. They can't travel on the weekends afternoon on Florida. What I want to know, is it fightable, and should he hire an attorney to try to fight it? Because I strictly asked Jay, I said, is it somewhere on the permit? And he said, it states in there if you look at clause such and such and such. And he said, and to be honest with you, he said, I didn't look at it. He said, until the guy showed me the clause.
I'm sorry. That's completely out of my wheelhouse. Maybe Hank got
something. Yeah. My office in Virginia has got some real heavy fines and some draconian fines. And there's a young man in my office who basically travels the state trying to get those fines reduced for people. And on the whole, the fines are heavy enough to even pay him as a lawyer to go and do that. In a way, you're fighting City Hall. There are some places in the country that I really think the little municipalities make their annual payroll based upon getting unsuspecting truckers.
Understood.
And I it doesn't sound like this particular bust is one of them. You can find transportation lawyers. In fact, you can call my office and ask Doug to help you find your carrier, the name of someone near where the hearing is going to be held, and maybe you'll get some local information on whether or not the DA will break the fine down. If it is a very clear violation, the best you're going to be able to do is, cut it down. But sometimes a lawyer can do that. If it's one of these $15,000 fines, I'd see dollars.
No, it's $1,000, and I really felt bad that he got it. Like I told you, I mean, I am a broker, but he's one of my regular guys. Most of my guys are regular, and I hated that he got it. And I would just actually got home from the grocery store.
Was this with the cars behind in front and back? I mean, is this
no? That, it was just no. It's just make? Permitted. He did not have to have escorts. It was just permitted.
Just
it was
a permitted load, and they cut it off. They cut it off during daylight hours.
Yep, they cut them off at noon. It was 9 foot 8 inches wide, and in the state of Florida, you can't drive after noon. And he rolled in at the weigh station at 2:33, and they nailed him.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice.
Part of Florida? What part of Florida was that in?
In the Panhandle.
Hmm.
And Ms. Seaton,
I hope you're going to say Orlando or somewhere in southern Florida where I knew somebody right offhand, but I don't.
No, he was going to, he was going, and they wouldn't even let him take his trailer up to, like, the motel, like 2 miles up the road. They wouldn't even let him take it up there. He had to park it at the weigh station overnight unattended. They wouldn't let him even stay with the trailer because he was going to sleep in the truck, and they wouldn't even let him stay in the truck.
Wow. Sounds like an abuse to me.
Yeah,
just for everyone listening on, Hank, I got your website pulled up, and if you want me to, I can give out the phone number.
Yeah, can you give it to me, sweetie, if you've got it?
Sure. It's 703-573-0700.
Okay. You know, like I said, I mean, I am a broker, but, you know, he's one of my best guys, and I love him to death, and I hate that he got nailed on it. And, you know, that's why I figured when I saw the thing, I would just call and see if maybe there was some sort of direction that I can go to for him.
And, $1,000
is worth trying to help, but I unfortunately don't have any transportation lawyer in the panhandle particularly.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your call, and I'll verify that that's where it was, but I'm thinking because he was only like 3.5 hours from delivery, and he was going on the west side of Florida more than I was sending him to Cutler, Florida, so, and he was about 4 hours out from delivery, so.
I
appreciate it,
guys.
In.
Sorry, we couldn't help out anymore. I'll give out that number one more time.
That's
Hank,
okay.
It's,
and all I can tell the guys that are on the line, if you're doing permitted loads, then it's January the 1st. The laws have changed in a lot of states. You know, just make sure that you remember what they are.
Yeah, and that's one of the things as professionals, that's something that we should be stay abreast upon anyway, is keeping up with the modern, with new laws and everything. We got to kind of make an effort to make sure that we stay abreast on those things. And just one more time, that phone number for Mr. Seaton's office is 703-573-0700. And Hank, we got one more caller got his hand up, wants to get in, and we'll go to them right now. Caller calling in from the area code 219. You're on live with Rico and Hank. What's your name and how can we help?
Hey Rico, it's Tom. How's it going, Mr. Hank?
Doing fine. What can we help you with?
One of the questions I've never understood is why don't shippers want to deal more with motor carriers than deal with brokers? Why don't they just deal with us directly and cut out the broker part?
Oh, well, I think you've got a good question. What happened basically as part of deregulation is most large shippers decided they could lay off their traffic departments or outsource their traffic departments. So they really don't have very deep on-site management to do it. And unfortunately, they've lost any real understanding about what our industry is all about. The people at the major shippers have a procurement or a purchasing department, but they wouldn't mm-hmm. know a cargo claim if they saw it. So what they have decided to do is to hire or outsource their traffic department. And typically they will say, well, Mr. Broker, if you can get your 15% out of the poor carrier and represent me in the transaction, that's a great deal. And it results in them not having to worry about credentialing a number of small carriers. They've got one point of contact, and the brokers have been better salesmen than the carriers have, because a small carrier has got to worry about making payments on the truck, find somebody to drive it, and all the fuel taxes and the rest and stuff. Well, a broker acts as kind of an outside sales force, you know. It's a whole lot easier to handle a whole lot of broker freight for a major shipper than it is to put on the trucks and actually provide the service. So it's become an attractive way to do it. And, of course, the broker industry, you got to realize, really proliferated after deregulation. Back when you had four or five choices for motor carrier service out of Syracuse, it was easy for traffic to be local and the local traffic manager to know who the carriers were and to vet them. Now that everybody's head haul is somebody's back haul, it's not something that the average shipper wants to staff up to handle. I hope that answers your question, but the smaller shippers will deal with small brokers and small carriers, but it's amazing to me how absolutely ill-informed major shippers are about who's hauling their freight, what the rates are, how the claims are being handled. Bigger doesn't necessarily mean they're more sophisticated.
I want to add a little something extra on top of that, Hank. Just from my experience, a lot of us as motor carriers, we have become fat, dumb, and happy. Just to put it, you know, and I'm not trying to say that in a derogatory sense, but, you know, and you alluded to it, it's so much easier just to get a load board and pay $35 a month, and I'm getting, and at the height of really good rates and seasonal demand, you could make a real good living out here on the spot market. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with making a good living on the spot market, and there's nothing wrong with dealing with brokers. However, if you really want to grow your business as a motor carrier, you have to venture out and go out and start to solicit direct sales. And the brokers are going out there and they are marketing to these shippers and they're going out and they're taking the time and effort. And all day long, they're making phone calls. And the thing that we have to do is if we really want to set ourselves apart, that's something that we as motor carriers have to start spending more time on educating ourselves on the sales process. How do we do sales? That's kind of like for the past couple of weeks when we had Chuck Snow on, the CEO of Traffix, last week. You know, I wanted him to try to break down and talk about the anatomy of a sales call. You know, and like I say, sometimes people feel like when we broach the subject that we're talking down on people that uses brokers. And I use brokers. We're not talking down on people that use brokers. I use brokers myself. I have some direct customers, and I also use brokers. I also broker freight. I kind of got my hand in all of the pots. But you know, that's the only way. In my humble and honest opinion, that's the only way that you are going to be able to grow your company is if you go out here and deliver excellent service to a couple of direct shippers. Who knows? They may say, "We like you so much, and we enjoy the service that you provide. Would you help us and assist us? We got all these other lanes. We would like it if you would just take over all of our freight." And then most trucking companies have brokerage arms of their company. And that's how they begin to help grow. And they cherry-pick the best lanes that they want to run their own trucks on. And then they broker out the other freight, the excess freight. You know, go ahead, Hank.
I didn't mean to talk over you, but I think you're making a good point I want to say amen to, and that is that, you know, for a small carrier, you really shouldn't just be using brokers as travel agents to get you around the country. The idea of finding a traffic lane or a niche in which you can build up some dependability with repeat customers on an outbound basis, and then get to where you know what the return freight is, so that you can conduct a balanced operation without having to hunt loads and zigzag home. I think is ultimately the way that a guy with one truck and a dream can add trucks and leverage off of the accounts he has to develop backhauls.
Can I throw something else out?
Sure.
I routinely go into, and I call it, I got the Opie Taylor factor because I'm the clean-cut white guy, you know. I'm no one way or the other. I'm not in any way offensive. I'm, you know, my truck's always clean. I got a brand-new trailer, so, of course, they like that. But what gets me is I go in there, and they're always telling me all the time, "Oh, here's our card. Anytime you need a load." Then I'll call them up, and they're like, "Oh, well, you need to go through so-and-so to get vented." And it's like, "Hey, guy, 30 seconds on a website, and you can see that I'm fully vented by the federal government already. But if you want to see it, I'll bring you a hard copy of my insurance, a hard copy of my authority, whatever you want to see." And it's like, to me, it's on their side. They're like, "Oh, we don't want to deal with this anymore. We just want so-and-so to do it." Well, so-and-so's not doing the job, be it a big company like a C.H. Robinson or a small company like Johnson's Brokerage Service, you know. I mean, if they're not getting the job done, it's like, why are y'all dealing with these people? Talk to us. We'll get it done for you.
That, But see, that's where our, like I said earlier, that's where our sales skills got to kick in, because if there's enough pain there that that shipper's experiencing from whoever they're dealing with, and if we can present a solution to their problem and make it so that it's easy for them, you know, make it easy, not saying that we're going to skip any of the process. There's still a way to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, but there's a certain way that you can smooth a client into getting what you want from them. You address, if you can address all of their needs and maybe even throw in a couple of their wants with their needs, then you are a pleasurable person to do business with, then there's no, I don't see any reason for them not to, you know, give you a shot as far as going directly. If the person that is the decision maker is right there, able to make that call. Now, sometimes you get into corporate, you know, when you get into a different, you know, with the big fish, then you got a whole bunch of political stuff that you got to go through. But we don't really need to be chasing those big fish anyway, because we don't have a gun big enough to shoot that bird.
Let me mention one other thing. I know we're probably getting close on time, but one provision that you will see in a broker contract is a covenant compete, and it'll say that you'll promise for the term of the contract and 2 years thereafter not to solicit any carrier for freight first tendered to you by the broker. And, of course, what that does is an anti-poaching provision, so it's intended so that, you know, you don't start taking freight from the broker and then go to the shipper and say, hey, let's cut that guy out and I'll do it cheaper. But, you know, I think it's important that you modify those provisions to say that you're not going to go out and solicit him, but if all of a sudden some shipper picks up the phone and calls you and says, hey, you know, I'm not doing business with Charlie's brokerage anymore. Do you want to haul for me direct? That's not the back soliciting. And so most big carriers will put in their contract that nothing in this back solicitation will prohibit me from responding to an unsolicitation by any customer at any time.
Well, mine is, it's the traffic manager. He'll walk out and give me his personal card and say, call me. And I'm like, okay, like I'm not, I thought I would, because I don't have to solicit that freight. 9 out of 10, they come out to me and say, here's my card, please call me.
Do you flip the script on him and say, well, because of my contract, I cannot call you, but here's my card, call me?
No, because I don't understand what I can and can't do, because, I mean, I don't go in there every time and start throwing out cards to everybody. I just, like, Rico, you know who I am, right?
Yes, sir.
Tom from Indianapolis. Okay. Well, you know, remember, I got that four-way camera system. 9 out of 10, a lot of people come out to my truck because they want to see all the little things I have on my truck. They'll see me getting into a real tight position and back in, and they say, how do you do that? And I point to my cameras, and they say, well, why do you do that? I said, well, this is to protect my business. This is to protect security of your load. And, I mean, traffic managers coming out, they're seeing it, and they're like, well, hey, boom, here's my card. You call me anytime you need a load. And I'm like, well, technically, I'm not supposed to take this, because we're not supposed to take freight from brokers. You know, it's supposed to be a gentleman's agreement, but it's like, well, hey, if the broker ain't getting the job done, shoot. I don't see why there's an issue. That's why I've been afraid
There probably is an issue if you have signed to the covenant not to back solicit. What you can probably tell the guy is, look, I've got a covenant not to back solicit you, but it doesn't keep you from reaching out to me. If you have problem getting a load covered. But I mean, you've got to be very careful in terms of how you do that. I'm not trying to suggest that you play cute with having signed a covenant not to back solicit and then kind of engage in it. But you know, I think you need to kind of think about it when you're going in. I don't think it's an ethical violation of any covenant not to back solicit. If all of a sudden let's say you're hauling for General Electric and they decide to put their freight out to for a year and they send you a bid package. And, you know, obviously a lot of my larger clients are not going to sign a back solicitation for some guy who has got his hand on the thigh of the traffic manager at East Sheboygan and now not be able to transport for General Electric anywhere. So, I mean, you know, that's the reason that those back solicitation provisions need to be looked at very closely.
Right. And we're actually in a little bit of an overtime there, so we don't want to keep Mr. Seaton any longer. We went over about 10 minutes, and we appreciate everyone for sticking in and hanging in there with us. I'd like to thank everyone that was able to make this show possible, Kevin Rutherford, Lisa Rutherford, and the entire Less Truck team. Of course, we want to send special thanks out to Mr. Hank Seaton for coming on with us and sharing of his time and knowledge. Please go support Mr. Seaton and check out his book, Protecting Motor Carriers' Interests and Contracts. Check out his website, transportationlaw.net. Hank, are you still looking on the new book? When we thinking about getting a new book out?
Oh, gee, if I could stop adding paragraphs to it, I'd be okay. You know, I it seems like it keeps rolling a month every time we talk. My editor has got about 3/4 of it back to me, so we're making some progress.
More is good. We like that. More is good. More information is good. But so we definitely want to thank you, Hank. And last but not least,
sure,
we want to thank each and every one of the callers and listeners and everyone that downloads and supports this podcast. We do it for you. And we're going to try to continue to expand and go deeper and make this thing better. If you have any questions, please check out the Facebook page for the Rates and Lanes. Of course, continue to support all of the groups, you know, the Rate Per Mile Masters, the Knowing Rates and Lanes, Motor Carrier Meetup, all of the different Facebook groups. Go and support all of them. And, you know, we do this to try to help make the motor carrier, to make the transportation industry a better place. And that's the whole purpose behind us doing it, to try to share knowledge and get actual good tangible information out there from legitimate professionals that can tell us that side. With that said, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you all once again. Thank you for your support. God bless you and good night. Thanks again, Mr. Seaton.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.